I'm referring to a certain global Italian food distribution network.
This is Roots of the Right, episode 1, Tradition. We're going to be looking at Revolt Against the Modern World. So that's Julius Evola's seminal masterwork. We're just looking at the first half of the book this time. We're also going to do some shorter readings, maybe an article here and there, some oration, and talk about that. And for this episode, we're going to finish it by telling you how to live your life, at least until you listen to the next podcast. So I'm going to kick it on to my other valued co-hosts. We've got Demok.
Hello.
We've got Mick.
G'day.
And I think you might have met this one before. Do you want to introduce yourself?
G'day, guys. I'm Bronzo. How's everyone doing?
The Bronzos. I'm sure you might have heard him around the traps before. So I suppose having another podcast on the right in Australia begs the question, why are we doing this, lads? Why another Dissident Right podcast?
Well, distinct lack of Aussies, I think.
Yeah, we're just straight up trying to take over podcasting to make it an Australian-only thing. And the next step in that is taking over the literature, culture, arts, history aspect of it. Previous projects just kicked everyone straight out of the water with good politics and news.
So, Drew, total hegemony of culture is what we're aiming for here, I suppose, boys. Am I right?
Mm-hmm. You're right.
Yeah. From the Oz Dissident Right sphere through the audio, we'll try and cover a little bit more of the, I suppose, the founding documents, principles, politics that have led us to the place that we are on the Dissident Right. For me, I couldn't help but get away from the metaphor of, you know, when you're setting up for a big lift, as all you lads do, you don't start by wiggling your fingers and reacting to what's going on around you, looking at the TV, seeing who's walking in the room. You start by making sure your feet are in the right place. And that's what this podcast, I hope, is for people. Realize where we've come from, and hopefully it'll tell us where we can go.
Exactly right. And I think if you set a really strong foundation in that way, hopefully what we can actually achieve with it is create a really robust platform of ideas for the movement going forward.
Definitely, definitely. And also, it's a good excuse for us to all brush up in our reading and stop just talking about books we've read and actually read them.
Very true, very true.
So with that in mind, I've got an opening reading for us. This is from a work that was contemporary with Evola, and a lot of people would argue that it inspired Revolt Against the Modern World in no small part. So it was from René Guénon. And he was a French author who later defected and became a bit of an Islamic mystic, but we'll leave that to one side. So this is from The Crisis of the Modern World, and it closes the book. Quote, "Those who will succeed in overcoming all these obstacles and triumphing over the hostility of an environment opposed to all spirituality will doubtless be few in number. But let it be said once more that it is not numbers that count, for we are here in a domain whose laws are quite different from those of matter. There is therefore no cause for despair, and even were there no hope of achieving any visible result before the modern world collapses under some catastrophe, this would still be no valid reason for not undertaking a work whose scope extends far beyond the present time. Those who might be tempted to give way to despair should realize that nothing accomplished in this order can ever be lost. That confusion, error, and darkness can win the day only in appearance and in a purely ephemeral way. That all partial and transitory disequilibriums must, perforce, contribute toward the greater equilibrium of the whole, and that nothing can ultimately prevail against the power of truth. Their motto should be the one formerly used by certain initiatic organizations of the West, Vincit Omnia Veritas." Translation for the last bit is, "Truth conquers all." So, René Guénon, how about that?
Very interesting. Yeah, one of the most radical traditionalist thinkers, and obviously a really heavy influence on not only Evola but also the entirety of the 20th century's conservative revolution, which kind of informed, you know, all of some of the regimes we might know and love today. yeah, so a very interesting figure who ended up in living in India and adopting a completely Eastern traditionalist view, which I think is probably going to come into play as we discuss further through Evola's book, because where he finds Western tradition lacking, he draws really very heavily on Eastern tradition, you know, the Aryan Persian tradition or the Hindu tradition or the Chinese tradition in some cases as well.
Yeah, did you get anything out of that, Demok?
Yeah,
apparently not.
we lost Demok, his ping was too high.
Yeah, sorry guys, tried to open Minecraft and it just crashed every router in the house. Yeah, it is quite apparent that his, it seems that the traditionalist thinkers do seem to shift a bit eastward, because they seem to have held on a lot more recently to these traditions than we have.
Weed futurism.
Yeah. Well, that's
for most places I've heard it referred to as like white Sharia. It's a bit of an idea around the zeitgeist at the moment. Speaking of which, it seems like everyone, not everyone, but nearly enough, are talking about revolt against the modern world now. In the show notes, we've included quite a few other channels or content creators that are talking about this. Culture Camp also previously has done a pretty deep dive, well, a really deep dive on revolt against the modern world, and they had on Survive the Jive, and that's a 5-hour masterwork if you've got the time.
Yeah.
And Philosopher Cat, who is one half of, I can't remember the duo that she's got. Has anyone listened to that album?
I'm actually not sure. No, I couldn't clarify that one for you.
Okay, so she's a musician and also a philosopher, and she's put out a video series on this work as well that's in progress. So she's only sort of up to maybe chapter 2 or 3, I think. And the point being is that it seems like, I mean, I never really went anywhere, but it's getting a lot of play at the moment. Have you lads noticed that?
The idea of the revolt against the modern world or the book itself, do you mean?
Well, both, yeah.
Yeah, certainly the idea of the revolt against the modern world is getting a lot of play on both sides of the spectrum as well. I mean, you know, some people would consider the left's street violence and stuff to be a revolt against the modern world, but just with different motives perhaps to ourselves. But I do think that certainly there's a lot of political tension and stuff around the way the modern establishment operates. And I think there is this drive for most people who are engaged in politics and not just kind of going along with what is the norm. There is a drive for those people to revolt against what is modern or what is current, for sure.
It's more or less just a facet of the Overton window shifting, I think. And it's the same with, like, you know, if you notice a spike in, say, the works of Kevin MacDonald in terms of how it's selling, for example. And it's just a lot more people are noticing. Oh God.
Certainly. There does seem to be a push to move away from what is the mainstream narrative. I think it's also important to look at it kind of in two different ways though, because there is two ways that modernity itself can be understood, which is like periodic modernity, which is the time period, which is like you've got the early modern era in the 1500s to the 1800s. You've got the modern era 1800s to kind of the mid 1900s. And now you've got, I suppose, the postmodern era. I guess that would come kind of after 1950-ish. And then there's also kind of a conceptual modernity, which is like what is contemporary, what is now, insofar as like thought, culture, work, etc. And this, I suppose what people are revolting against is not a periodic modernity, but a revolt against contemporary thought or modern thought. And then to bring that back into Evola's writing, he takes a really broad position on modernity, actually discussing how it tangibly manifests kind of between the 8th and 6th centuries, which is more reflective of the traditional Hindu ages or yugas. So he writes about how we're in the Kali Yuga, and that again is something that's discussed quite in depth in our circles. So what do you guys think about that?
Yeah, I think it's really important for this show that I'm going to try to assume kind of nothing of the audience, because I really hope that anyone could stumble across this and get something out of it. And part of that is, if we're going to, you know, if we're talking about the Kali Yuga, so yeah, those sort of broad ages in Hindu mysticism that describe events and perturbances that can be expected to occur around those times. So I can quote from the foreword here, just to back up what you were saying there, Bronze. So the quote is, as far as the historical aspect is concerned, it is necessary to indicate the width of the horizons confronting us. In an anti-traditional sense, the first forces of decadence began to be tangibly manifested between the 8th and the 6th centuries BC. As can be concluded from the sporadic and characteristic alterations in the forms of the social and spiritual life of many peoples that occurred during this time. Thus, the limit corresponds to so-called historical times, since according to many people, whatever occurred before this period no longer constitutes the object of history. History is replaced by legends and myths, and thus no hard facts can be established, only conjectures. The fact remains, however, that according to traditional teachings, the above-mentioned period merely inherited the effects of an even more remote causes. During this period, what was presaged was the critical phase of an even longer cycle known in the East as the Dark Age, which we referred to here as the Kali Yuga, in the classical world as the Iron Age, and in the Nordic sagas as the Age of the Wolf.
Yep. So he kind of goes into that overlap between the different cultures' conception of that Dark Age, or the Demon Age, I suppose it is in the Hindu sense.
Yeah, so most people, we were talking about it before we went to air, might say that, you know, modernity kind of began with the end of the Second World War or after the 50s, or even if you take it back, as I, prior to reading this book and sort of anecdotally had picked up, maybe around the 1920s or 30s. But really, I suppose modernity and its accompanying ills go back a bit further than that, or that seems to be Evelyn's argument.
Certainly, as we work our way through the book, I think, or work our way through the ideas of the book at least, we're going to see where Evelyn's coming from with this idea that it goes back to a certain point. Obviously, his idea of the... Well, he's contrasting the man of tradition and the man of modernity, I suppose. And we see that he finds this downward trajectory to be kind of a result of our move away from an understanding of the invisible and the intangible and towards the physical and the material kind of world. That's how he sees it. And I suppose you could argue that that goes back, you know, several centuries quite easily. But yeah, the contemporary understanding of our downward trajectory is kind of post-World War II, I suppose.
I think we do tend to be a bit focused on World War II because it's basically where our culture stopped developing, really. Like, everything afterwards was about World War II. Yeah, so we tend to get that lens effect.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a huge turning point for sure, because there is it does seem like there was like not only a halt in the development of culture, but the development of achievement as well. Even as we achieved things in technology and that, we kind of weren't. I suppose that the only real achievement that comes to mind after that is sending man to the moon. What do you guys think of that?
Yeah, and I think, well, the Soviet, you know, space race thing as well, like just the Soviet versus the West was more or less just an A-B test as to see which system would win out in the end. And, well, we know how that went. It's a footnote in history, to be honest, I think, compared to, like, the First World War and the Second World War.
Absolutely, yeah. I would agree.
Yeah, I found... I'd absolutely agree with you, especially with regards to the sort of moon landing, et cetera. I think it was only this year that we celebrated, what was it, the 50th anniversary?
Yeah.
It would be 1969, I think it was, wasn't it?
Yeah. That rattled me. Like, where has been the moonshot for our generation?
Yeah, nothing.
We haven't had one.
Anything of that, yeah. Well,
that's so I just, the peak of our civilization.
Actually, it was Bodie McBoatface. So
we weren't paying attention. Slipped under the radar. Thanks for bringing that up, Demog. That's good.
It's good content. Great content here on the...
As far as the achievement goes, and we've been talking technologically here, which interestingly enough, despite all the memes about writing Revolt Against the Modern World, against technology getting broken, like, you know, eagles swooping on kids' drones and stuff, the only time Evola mentioned technology that I recall, I'm going to get owned probably because someone's probably found another passage from the first half of this book.
Oh, please email. Yeah.
In the first half, the only time I recall him mentioning technology at all was in the context of the World War One.
Mm.
He was against it, but other than that, he didn't mention
technology. We're definitely going to get into that. So there's some excellent points that he makes around the mechanization of warfare and warfare going from being a divine exercise of identity or wills triumphing against one another to a simple process of numbers and technology. So what we're doing now is, I suppose, we're going to move into the book proper. We're not going to do it anywhere near the same level of service that other shows or reviewers or, you know, people may have done in the past, but it's really just to give our listeners or people into this a glimpse into the work and hopefully encourage them to go and check it out for themselves. I'll just do a bit of housekeeping though. The philosophy cat that I mentioned at the beginning of the show is actually called Cat Weiss. The band that I referenced was, they're called Uberfolk. So they got an album out. The album that I was talking about is called Music for Nations. So didn't want to name check without clearing it up. So I'm looking now at the first chapter, aptly titled The Beginning. So referencing what we were just talking about, particularly, I think, Mick, you were talking about the sort of other revolts in modernity against materialistic views or, you know, the Kali Yuga. There's a quote here which is pretty interesting, pretty early in the chapter. Thus, the majority of the intellectual revolts against materialistic views are only vain reactions against the latest peripheral effects stemming from remote and deeper causes. These causes, incidentally, arose in a different historical context from the one in which the theories were formulated. The experience of traditional man used to reach well beyond these limits, as in the case of some so-called primitive people, among whom we still find today a faint echo of spiritual powers from ancient times. In traditional societies, the invisible was an element as real, if not more real, than the data provided by the physical senses. Every aspect of the individual and of the social life of the people belonging to these societies was influenced by this experience. So I feel like that speaks a little bit to Evola's dichotomy, or at least the way that he sets his work up. Did your understanding kind of come in line with that, Bronz?
Certainly. What I found is that he kind of sets out his arguments in a bipolar way. So he contrasts like two different things in opposition. The one that I found kind of to be prominent throughout the book and throughout this chapter particularly is like, I think he sets it out this way. I don't have the book at hand right now, but metaphysical and physical and being and becoming were the two things that I really saw. And then those things kind of channel down into the invisible and visible, tangible, intangible, and immortal and mortal. But he seems to outline how the invisible and the intangible dimension is really the core and the origin of everything that is experienced materially.
Mm. Yeah, he does. In closing that chapter, so I won't go for the big block quote, I might skip around a bit, but he says, these were the two natures. Tradition conceived the possibility of being born in either one and also the possibility of going from one birth to another, according to the saying, a man is a mortal god and a god is an immortal man. So this is the notions of being and becoming.
Yeah.
And then skipping ahead, the traditional word knew divine kingship. It knew the bridge between the two worlds, namely initiation. It knew the two great ways of approach to the transcendent, namely heroic action and contemplation. It knew the mediation, namely rights and faithfulness. It knew the social foundation, namely the traditional law and the caste system. And it knew the political earthly symbol, namely the empire. These are the foundations of the traditional hierarchy and civilization that have been completely wiped out by the victorious anthropocentric civilization of our contemporaries. That's sort of his, I know it's pretty stirring stuff at the end, but that last section that I read pretty well sums up his thesis or his central critique that makes up the majority of the book. Would you agree, Demont?
Yeah, it's a fair summary. In fact, I think the whole polar thing Bronce was talking about, he actually explicitly goes over just a few chapters later. About polar symbolism, about spirit and matter, all of that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I think as well, something that's quite like marked in this chapter is that he kind of like views this modernity as an era marked by defiance of the gods,
and
rejection of the spiritual, which is a theme throughout the entire book. I kind of see, I think he states that his contention actually is that the worst type of materialism is that man's experience no longer extends to the non-physical, which is a really important part of his thesis. So this is kind of where we see him also advocating for the for his authority as being I need to find my words here, but its authority must be derived from a higher power, but it also his ideal hierarchical structure must be oriented upwards so that the group or the society of being, because he goes into the castes later as well, is all fulfilling their role upward and towards a higher goal. So I think that's an interesting way to view the society. I suppose we'll break that down. I might be getting ahead of myself here. We'll be breaking that down later. And
You're referring to a lot of the content in the next chapter.
Yeah.
I just figure if we're sort of moving through, so we're just going to be talking, as I mentioned at the head, but about the first part of the book. So the first part of Revolt Against the Modern World is called The World of Tradition. So we've just come through the beginning. Chapter 2's Regality. But I'll flag before we go on, if we didn't cover a lot of Evola himself and his background and his contemporaries and his involvement with several political matters at the time, all of that's pretty available information. We are going to include in the show notes a link to an article called The Legacy of a European Traditionalist, Julius Evola in Perspective. So if you go and check that out, that answers a lot of those questions or provides a lot of reading into it. I suppose we'll just move on with the book. So what you were just talking about, that sort of divine nature of kingship or regality, there's a pretty clear mandate here that there's this thread throughout stories, narratives, and myths of the time of kings having not only a divine mandate but a divine character. So closing the chapter, which is a bad place to start, but Evola quotes Joseph de Maistre, who wrote, "God makes kings in the literal sense. He prepares royal races, maturing them under a cloud which conceals their origin. They appear at length crowned with glory and honor. They take their places, and this is the most certain sign of their legitimacy. The truth is that they arise as if, as it were, of themselves, without violence on their part and without marked deliberation on the other. It is a species of magnificent tranquility, not easy to express. Legitimate usurpation would seem to me to be the most appropriate expression, if not too bold, to characterize these kinds of origins, which time hastens to consecrate." So I think I was talking before we went to recording. I think I said to Mick that pretty much sounds like our politicians now, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Scott Morrison is the embodiment of the sun god.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. I feel like, you know, if he was the true PM, There's the argument in this chapter that Philip of Valois, if he was the king, he should subject himself to hungry lions. Yeah, that'd be fine. Yeah. It'd work.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And if he should fail, he'd be unworthy of the seat. It seems reasonable for most candidates for PM, I think.
Absolutely.
I believe in the God Emperor. Yeah, Morris would be fine.
These days.
Dogar Blimp.
Yeah,
I think this gets it. Like again, his yeah, of course, his idea of being divinely anointed for a role, and in the case of the like traditionally fulfilling that role, it's not necessary perhaps that you be physically strong or you embody the physical qualities, you know, intelligence or strength or wisdom or courage, I think are the ones he lines out.
Yeah.
But rather that you were chosen for that role by nature of being born into that body. But also that these things such as achievement through victory, so claiming a kingship or some other kind of highly dignified office through combat is a kind of a natural embodiment of the higher meaning and a divine judgment. So that is the way that it, so we know kings were at times through history were anointed through defeating another king in combat, right? Not in England, but in other societies, or leaders of a tribe were decided that way, and that is essentially the gods making their divine judgment.
Yeah, there's another section in that chapter which I stuck out to me, which was in the Nordic racial stocks up to the time of the Goths, and notwithstanding the principle of royal sacredness, the king was considered as an Aesir, or a high one, and as a demigod who wins in battle thanks to the power of his good fortune. An inauspicious event was understood not so much as the absence of the mystical power of fortune abiding in the king, but rather as a consequence of something that the king, as a mortal man, had done, thus compromising the objective effectiveness of his power. So there was definitely a metaphysical, as you're saying there, it's kind of metaphysical dimension to it all. Yeah. You know, you had power not by right of having had the capacity to take it in the first place, but also having the capacity to maintain it.
Yeah, absolutely.
And to have that tranquility in rule.
Definitely.
That, yeah, we don't see too much now. Yeah.
No, we don't see that at all now. Like, I mean, our rulers these days, and this is part of why I think people have this... well, because obviously this is the way our society's progressed over time. And now that we don't have this, rather we have leaders who are led by money, by donations and things like that. I think these are the fuels for the desire of modern man to revolt against the modern world and look for either a society of tradition or just something completely different that's hasn't been tried, that's in the future. I suppose we see that in the left, and in the right we see a look, we tend to see a look towards tradition, although of course some of us want to pair that tradition with something entirely new, something that hasn't been tried before in a way, but we know it can work. So,
but it's still critically, I think the critical differentiation there is that trying something in line with nature or in defiance of nature.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's the
sticking point.
Yeah. Mick, did you get the same things out of that, or did you get anything out of the reading?
Yeah. As far as rule by divine right goes, I'd say it does indeed sound pretty cool. I'm going to have to, next Aussie election, I'm going to vote for rule by divine right.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Or subject them all to trial by combat.
I don't oppose that, you know.
It'd be a lot cheaper and a lot quicker than other options.
Could be a lot.
Made a best man win, right? You just kind of get all the candidates in one room and, you know, give them assorted chairs and sticks and stuff to fight each other with, and whoever comes out on top should lead our country.
It'd be pretty much like the parliaments in several other countries as well. Greece, never get tired of those pictures. Yeah,
Nigerian parliament or something like that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
it'd be very funny seeing Bill Shorten run around with a chair, you know, right above his head. So,
So clipping along to the next chapter, which is Polis Symbolism, the Lord of Peace and Justice, probably the key theme coming into this, Evola's knowledge of and reference to Eastern and sort of Northern traditions like Hinduism, as we mentioned at the beginning, and Nordic sort of Indo-European beliefs, it's all throughout the book. I won't get into that mainly because the pronunciations are pretty intimidating, but there's a quote in this chapter which is, I think, spoke to what you were just talking about. So he said that stability was the main sort of point or at the center of the Indo-Aryan formula for the consecration of kings. And I think this is from a consecration which says, remain steady and unwavering. Do not give in. Be strong like a mountain. Stay still like the sky and the earth, and retain control of power at all times. The sky, the earth, and the mountains are unmoved. As unmoved is the world of living beings and this king of men. That was how I used to confirm kings in the age of tradition, as Evola would have it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Well, I think that's what you kind of were pointing out before, is the stability and the tranquility of a leader.
Yeah.
And that is, I suppose, a divine gift, that ability. So you could see why the man of tradition kind of respected that quality in their leader. I think in the chapter as well, he goes over the concept of a king of justice. Did you guys have any notes of that? Any notes on that, sorry, I should say? Or do you want me to elaborate?
No, if you've got stuff on King of Justice, that's good.
Yeah, I'll elaborate quickly there. So it's he discusses that the equivalent term for it, it determines that justice and peace don't have a secular meaning at all. They are a kind of spiritual, the term is spiritual in its original context, and it refers to the proper nature of the divine ruler or the king. And he goes on to discuss how, like, a primordial legislation that hierarchically orders, that is hierarchically ordered, will be in a system that's oriented upwards. So every function and form of life is oriented towards this same goal, and the king is the at the head of it by divine, you know, judgment. And I think the idea here is that each group is fulfilling their role. The king is born into their role, selected to fulfill this role. This is what I found to be the strongest theme throughout the book. That's why it might sound like I'm kind of going on about it or whatever, but I think really it's the idea is that they're selected for this role, they're born into it. And it's the nature of that being to fulfill that role and actually to go outside of the role, or to fulfill a function outside of your own nature is kind of the abomination for the man of tradition.
Yeah, you've moved through chapters 3 and 4 pretty well there. So chapter 4 is the law, the state and the empire. So if you, read through that, I think that what you were summarizing there is pretty much the central argument through those. Sort of everything has a place and everything in its place. So there's one quote that I'll share from that, and then we'll kind of kick on.
We got up to the polar symbolism chapter. Had I jumped ahead?
We're all the way through it. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Beautiful. Because that's what I was talking about. We're through to 4. The Lord of Peace and Justice stuff.
Yeah. Kind excellent. Of okay. Well, yeah. In opening the law, the state, and the empire, so chapter 4, he says, as a natural consequence, traditional man neither ignored or considered absurd the idea that one could talk about laws and the obedience due them if the laws in question had a mere human origin, whether individual or collective. Every law, in order to be regarded as an objective law, had to have a divine character. Once the divine character of a law was sanctioned and its origin traced back to a non-human tradition, then its authority became absolute. This law became then something ineffable, inflexible, immutable, and beyond criticism. Thus, every transgression of such law was regarded not so much as a crime against society, but rather and foremost as sacrilege or as an act of impiety, or as an act that jeopardized the spiritual destiny of the person who disobeyed it, as well as of the people with whom that person was socially related. So I suppose that's speaking to what you were just saying about the, you know, caste system and the hierarchies and everything pointing upwards, the divine mandate of kings covered in, you know, regality and the Lord of Peace and Justice extended all the way down. And diverting from that, Evola's argument was just inconceivable.
Yeah, absolutely. And to the people in each group as well, even if they were, you know, of a lower status or of a less dignified position, it wasn't kind of less dignified to not be the king. It was less dignified to just not fulfill your role. And that's obviously a healthy society is, and I've discussed this in other things, if people who are listening have heard me talk before, I've discussed how the purpose of a society, the reason why humans created societies, is to find a role for people. And in a mutual sense, it was that the people fulfilled a role for the society and the society found a role for the people. And that's essentially this same mechanism in the traditional society. It's just that you're born into your role rather than achieving it through the pursuit of reward. So, I mean, I suppose people can make up their own mind about which way sounds healthier. But, you know, to me, I think, and this is, I suppose, this idea of being born into a position and not being able to achieve anymore is why Jonathan Bowden described Evola as the most right-wing thinker that they'd ever tackled at that conference where he said that. But it seems like a reasonably healthy way to construct a society. And I suppose that's the being as opposed to the becoming, right? You are being what you are to the best of your ability rather than attempting to become for a reward. So, what do you guys think of that?
Well, I mean, you only have to poll the average person on how happy they are in, you know, modern times, and you sort of see a massive decline in bygone days, essentially, where people had predetermined roles that, you know, they were sort of set on this track for life, whereas now you're kind of, as soon as you're out of the school pipeline is where you're kind of, you know, you're foisted into the world and you just have no clue as to what you do. So there's no place for you in society. You just, you know, just go do whatever, man. But people need to be told what they should do, I think.
Absolutely. And I think that's, you have a look at kind of things like rising suicide rates and that kind of thing. And it's like, you know, are these things the product of oppression, or are they, you know, as we're told, or are they really the product of aimlessness? Are they the product of the tyranny of choice? I think it's like as our options have opened up, we've seen an increase in suicidality and things like that. And even we see it in, you know, you talk about women's suffrage and how they've received more rights than that over the years. Well, look at there's studies on, you know, women's general happiness and life satisfaction and stuff like that. And it's been going down since they started to record it, which I think was the 60s or the 70s. But it's like your rights have only expanded since then. And yet, you know, your options and your freedoms have expanded, and yet you're less happy. And we see that in men as well. So
you're free to just become another cog in the machine, essentially, isn't it? Rather than, you know.
Yeah. I really want to kind of – sorry, go on.
I was going to say, rather than fulfilling your preordained biological role as a caregiver for your offspring, you know, it's just, here you go. Have a job. Have an office job, lol.
Absolutely, yeah. That's a move away from tradition in and of itself. You had something to say there, Thimos?
No, I was going to say, that what you were both just talking about there, he really taps into and speaks to directly in the latter chapters of the first part. But I'm just conscious, sort of time and everything else, but also complexity. So I don't know if you had a lot of takes around the next sort of two chapters, so spiritual virility and the two parts in the afterlife. They were quite esoteric. I had some things that we can sort of touch upon. Did you have many notes for it at all, Demok?
No, I can't even read. I purposefully forgot because of this book.
Appeal to tradition so much. Yeah, he's gone through the rite of...
I just kind of wanted to read a paragraph from one of the last things Yukio Mishima said before he committed seppuku in front of a bunch of blokes in Japan. And this is after World War II, after the emperor and all of Japan had basically surrendered to America. And I'll just sort of see if this sort of coincides with anything that, you know, we've been saying about Evola and spirituality and the king and all that. We have watched as post-war Japan has become infatuated with economic prosperity and forgotten the foundational principles of the nation. Citizens have lost their solidarity, rush ahead without correcting fundamental problems, have fallen into stopgap measures and hypocrisy, and have cast their own souls into a state of emptiness. Politics is just facade over a mass of contradictions, self-preservation, lust for power, and hypocrisy. Any long-term plans for the nation 100 years from now have been consigned to foreign countries. We have watched with gritted teeth as the shame of defeat has been ducked and avoided rather than wiped away, and as Japanese themselves sully their own history and traditions. So this is kind of like you sort of see the a country becoming undone, as it were, from, you know, Evola's conception of where we should be, I guess. Mm. And now that they've joined the modern world, you know, they suffer the same problems that we do.
Mm. Yeah, I think that does coincide pretty neatly. Yeah. Do you want to just repeat that name so people, you know, listeners can go and check it out?
He was the most based nip, essentially.
Yeah. I mean, I know the story, but
yeah, you know,
people don't. Yeah.
Well, he's got some pretty good works out there. He's just sort of halfway through reading Sea of Fertility, and in that book, he kind of it's fiction, it's a work of fiction, but he sort of goes through what it was like post-Meiji Japan, essentially, what would culminate in the collapse of the society as they knew it there and into what it is now, Globo Homo Gayplex.
So I'll jump ahead a little bit just based on what we've been talking about and sort of in the interest of time. I encourage people, obviously, the whole point of the show is to get us to finally read all the stuff we've been talking about and also to hopefully encourage other people to do the same. So we'll jump ahead through chapters 7 and 8, go to 9, which is life and death of civilizations. So I think this talks to exactly what we've just been discussing. There's a quote towards the end of it where Evola says, "A civilization's degree of faithfulness to tradition is determined by the degree of the predominance of cults and rituals of the first type over the second type. Likewise, the nature and the function of the rites proper to the world of spiritual virility is specified." So if you read through the earlier chapters, I know this is a great podcast, but if you read through the earlier chapters, it makes a little bit more sense in context. The point that he makes, though, is that a characteristic of what today goes by the name of the science of religions is that whenever by sheer chance it finds the right key to solve a mystery, it reaches the conclusion that this key is good to solve all mysteries. Thus, when some scholars learned about the idea of the totem, they began to see totems everywhere. The totemic interpretation was shamelessly applied to the forms found in great civilizations, since some scholars thought that the best explanation for them could be derived from earlier studies on primitive tribes. Last but not least, the sexual theory of the totem eventually came to be formulated. So he's just talking about, we've seen the decay of these civilizations, and we've seen, you know, faithfulness and tradition diminishing. And what's risen in its wake is just an empirical study of the ruin.
Or bugmanism.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, he brings up the sort of bugmanism and the sheer weight of focus on economics and technology throughout. Did you have anything on that, Bronze?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think that that I'm not going to refer to anything specific in that chapter because I think broadly the chapter itself actually lends itself to a really, really powerful reflection of like where we are today. I suppose you could say that in any time you could lament the loss of tradition. But for me, particularly today, we've done away, we can actually see the process of how we've done away with, you know, religious institutions. We've done away with the traditional institution of marriage. We've done away with the tradition of a people with a consciousness of themselves. And what that's been replaced with is things like scientism, right? Mm. So everything must be empirical. Everything must be written in a peer-reviewed paper or something like that. Mm. And I think all of us here understand some of the problems with that. You know, like we've got an issue with things like publication bias and stuff like that. And yet this is the ultimate good, is these elites writing down information for us. So
yeah,
we've moved away from that.
And then saying it's, you know, empirical data.
Exactly.
Oh, yeah. Without doxing myself too much, and it'll lead into the next point that I'm going to make, but I'm deeply aware. I've got a very, very good understanding, and it's one of the things that actually led me to the position that I'm in, like personally and politically. So moving on, I suppose, to another point that needs to be mentioned and related to the scientism that we were just talking about. So this is from, again, Life and Death of Civilizations. Another quote that he had was, "Blood and ethnic purity are factors that are valued in traditional civilizations too. Their value, however, never justifies the employment, in the case of human beings, of the same criteria employed to ascertain the presence of pure blood in a dog or in a horse, as is the case in some modern racist ideologies. The blood or racial factor plays a certain role not because it exists in the psyche, in the brain and in the opinions of an individual, but in the deepest forces of life that various traditions experience and act upon as typical formative energies. The blood registers the effects of this action, yet it provides through heredity a material that is preformed and refined, so that through several generations, realizations similar to the original ones may be prepared and developed in a natural and spontaneous way. It is on this foundation, and on this foundation only, that, as we shall see, the traditional world often practiced the heredity of the castes and willed endogamous laws." That could be taken as pretty controversial, but I'd like to hear your takes on it.
I'd say as far as that's concerned, what we're seeing there is his kind of esotericism and mysticism, his base in that kind of showing through. Mm. Look, I'm not going to be one to counter signal Evola, right? I'm not going to pretend I'm this big brain guy and I can, you know, I'm gonna epically own Evola the libtard.
Punching right.
Yeah, I'm punching right. Yeah. But what I will say is, like, I think this idea is applicable if you just understand it. And I hate to revert to what I just called, you know, kind of dumb and gay, but I had to revert to some scientism. But basically, he's referring to biology. Right. Yeah. Like, I mean, this is the refinement, I suppose you would call it, of certain traits or skills of a people. And really that is, that does lend itself to an understanding of race in the racist context that he decries.
Well, it's a framework to work from, isn't it? I mean, it's like, it's the reason that white people are as altruistic as they are is because we evolved in a colder climate, and, you know, thousands of years of evolution have dictated that we be nice to one another to ensure our survival, I suppose.
For better or worse, right?
Yeah, well, it's not so great now.
Sort of reading here, I found myself constantly doing the same thing, like seeing stuff he'd say and say was a spiritual phenomenon and trying to figure out how it would scientifically work. Wait a minute, I'm countersigning the Ebola, so I guess I'm just gay then. So,
I guess I'm a libtard.
Yeah, particularly when he goes on to laws, I was thinking, like, oh yeah, if all of your laws are like decrees of God, you can just be a full libertarianism and like a full maximum libertarian and, you know, just burn heretics. That's the only thing you need to persecute. I was like, wait a minute, but this has spiritual implications, which I've just ignored.
Mm.
I'm a materialist and probably a communist too.
That was
the whole scientism thing. Like back earlier when we were talking about the anointing of the Indo-Aryan kings, like that, their recited lines about their stability was like poetry, and they've got a whole thing where ruling is just as much art as science, if not more art. Whereas in modern ruling, you go, nah, we can measure this. We'll just measure the GDP. The more GDP, the more rulerer you are.
The more worker units we have in a given country.
Yeah, just make the stocks go up.
Yeah. Stonks.
And then you win. Stonks.
Yeah, big stonks. You got to shuffle those numbers around, right? You got to make big growth for the economy. And if the economy's not growing enough, you got to bring in a bunch of Indians to buy toilet paper, I suppose. So.
And it turns into like an inverted version of evolism, which is like hypermaterialism, where like instead of going, we're going to have an economy so that we can live better, we go, got to sacrifice it for the economy. Got to do it for the economy, man.
Exactly, yeah. It's like rather than Evola's idea of the immaterial being the origin of all that happens in the material, we're actually like flipping it on its head and we're like, well, the material is the origin of everything that happens in the immaterial. But for us, the immaterial is not some spiritual realm. It's just numbers in a computer representing, you know, dollars.
Precisely. How much money can the Federal Reserve print, sort of thing?
Yeah, well, I don't know if the I don't know if I'm willing to put a limit on that.
Hyperinflation when?
How quickly can you spin the machine?
That's it. It's like a slot machine for them. Pull that lever and there's more cash out for you. Yeah, where were we up to there? I might just...
So I think we can hop ahead. No, it was good. It was really good because what I hope to do is do a little bit of a, you know, a big brain word here, but exegesis. So we're dragging out things from the text. I know it's good. Yeah, you're welcome. it's talking about kind of points from the text, but referring to things outside of it and things that are going to be relevant to us and to people listening. So we don't need to go through it sequentially. In fact, I think Evola would be proud of us, just, you know,
yeah,
whatever.
Like even though I can't.
Ancients had a different concept of time and space, so we can just pick any part of the book and run with it.
Well, he spends a big part of chapter one making just that argument that, you know, time was largely just inconsequential. So, yeah, I think we're out of it. And chapter 19 we'll finish up too. Talks about space, time, Earth. Yeah, we're good. We're fine. So
I think the quote is, and I could be wrong, this could actually be Heidegger, but I think the quote is, time is just a series of meaningless events, one after the other. Yeah, so.
That sounds like Heidegger.
Doesn't it? Yeah, doesn't it?
What a sentence. All right. So chapter 13, I think he talks to some of the things that we were just talking about there. So we've skipped ahead a little bit. But there's a Paul quote. So chapter 13 is titled The Soul of Chivalry. And he said, with the decline of chivalry, the European nobility also eventually lost the spiritual element as a reference point for its highest faithfulness, and thus became part of merely political organisms, as in the case of the aristocracies of the national states that emerged after the collapse of the civilization of the Middle Ages. The principles of honor and of faithfulness continue to exist even when the noble was nothing but a king's officer. But faithfulness is blind when it does not refer, even in a mediated way, to something beyond the human dimension. Thus, the qualities that were preserved in the European nobility through heredity eventually underwent a fatal degeneration when they were no longer renewed in their original spirit. The decline of the regal spirituality was unavoidably followed by the decline of nobility itself and the advent of the forces found in a lower order. So I think those lower order forces were what we're talking about towards the end there, you know, just it's all about them stonks.
It's about the stonks, about the stonk market,
Yeah.
Yep. Stonk market department. Hello.
How are your commodities performing? Yeah. Who do you work for? The modern kind of cases of nobility.
Do you like to purchase these trenches in housing that I've got so that I can collapse the entire infrastructure of this economy next year?
Yeah, that's it. Yeah.
Right. So we'll move on. On now to chapter 13. So again, the soul of chivalry. So there was another quote there that I feel sums up a lot of what we've just been talking about, and then we can probably push on through. So Evola writes, these instances of inner contradiction within a traditional political order regulated by the caste system must be considered an exception to the rule. They become predominant, though, in a society that no longer knows the castes and, in general, in distinct social organisms in which there is no law to gather, preserve, and shape talents and qualifications in view of specific functions. Here we encounter a chaos of existential and psychic possibilities that condemn most people to a state of disharmony and social tension. We can see plenty of that nowadays. Yeah.
We touched on this earlier, didn't we?
We absolutely did. Undoubtedly, there may have been a margin of indetermination even in the case of traditional man, but this margin in him only served to emphasize the positive aspects of these two sayings. Know yourself, complemented by the saying nothing superfluous, and be yourself, which implied an action of inner transformation and organization leading to the elimination of this margin of indetermination and to the integration of the self. That was a tough read.
That was a lot of nations in there.
Love how the more you think about it, the more be yourself actually turns out to be really good advice.
True, yeah. And not just some superfluous fucking thing that people often say to, you know, to people going on their first date or whatever. Just be yourself.
Yeah, it's actually tradition.
It's pretty trad and chad from a philosophical perspective to just be yourself.
Exactly. But as we were saying before, nobody knows what their self is these days, and you're put through a mill essentially, which gives you a generic education, and then you're forced upon the world to do whatever, I guess, and you don't have any direction whatsoever.
Exactly. And in fact, in many cases, you're stripped of what it is to be yourself. You know, you go through school, and again, I'm bringing it back to the modern world, and I'm going to critique it here, but it's like you go through school and you rote learn, your opinions don't particularly matter. And then you go to uni where it's meant to be, you know, you're meant to be this free thing. A lot of uni students think they are this free thinker or whatever, but not really. Like, that's kind of beaten out of you, and you're told to read from these studies, these researchers, these scientists very often. And
you're essentially sold a narrative by your Marxist professors, essentially.
Exactly. And that becomes what you are. So no, you're kind of no longer being yourself. You're becoming something different. You're operating in the realm of becoming rather than in the realm of being and the realm of trying to understand yourself. You're just taking understanding from others.
Yeah, you're just a foot soldier of the establishment.
Very much.
I just thought I'd clarify from that thing too. It wasn't actually from chapter 13, that was from 14. So that was from the Doctrine of the Castes. I'm just looking at the wrong chapter heading. So moving on through, the next chapter after that was Professional Associations and the Arts. Slavery. Hell of a title.
Interesting. I think this is kind of why he might have been described as the most right-wing thinker, you know, of all, is because he has these ideas that are completely antithetical to anything modern, anything, because we live in an age of egalite, right? We have equality, we have egalitarianism, we have
egalite.
We have merit, and he is operating completely outside that realm. And he's offering ideas that are very novel in a society like ours.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. It's not so much a direct refutation on his part, but it's a complete tangent. It's a complete, like, parallel system of thought. Total rejection. So everything from sort of 600 years before all of this kicked off, is that's where I'm sitting. And it is. It's a really interesting perspective to take. And I found that while I was reading this and, you know, getting ready for the show, that I was doing that more and more myself, just looking around in day-to-day life and thinking, where are the roots for what I'm seeing? What is this really? And very often the answer that would come back was nowhere. There's not much to it.
Yeah, no. And I think that's kind of a general thing that most people of our political persuasion sort of undertake. And it's why I often describe it as it's like a different lens under which you view the world and how everything sort of came about. And once you peer into that abyss, you cannot unsee what you have seen, essentially.
Absolutely, yeah. Well, we've moved away from understanding something as coming from like a single metaphysical truth, which is what he talks about with tradition, where everything comes from, is divinely gifted or whatever, and we've come to this point where we don't need to be informed by that, because we're informed by this thing that we make. We are operating completely in the material world, and we are, as Evola says, completely disconnected from the immaterial, from the intangible.
Yeah, it's
sorry, I kind of diverted there with my
that's good
initial part.
But talking about exactly what we've just touched on. So from the chapter, I just mentioned that Professional Associations and the Art, Slavery. I highlighted a pretty large section, but I hope you'll forgive it. He said, If the modern world has disapproved of the injustice of the caste system, it has stigmatized much more vibrantly those ancient civilizations that practiced slavery. Recent times boast of having championed the principle of human dignity. This, too, is mere rhetoric. Let us set aside the fact that Europeans reintroduced and maintained slavery up to the 19th century, it's a bit controversial, in their overseas colonies in such heinous forms as to be rarely found in the ancient world. What should be emphasized is that if there ever was a civilization of slaves on a grand scale, the one in which we are living is it.
Wade no tradition. Sorry.
Huh? No, go on.
Wages dab dog.
That's true.
Wages, absolutely wages dab dog, yeah. How's that cubicle? No traditional civilization ever saw such great masses of people condemned to perform shallow, impersonal, automatic jobs in the contemporary slave system. The counterparts of figures such as lords or enlightened rulers are nowhere to be found. This slavery is imposed subtly through the tyranny of the economic factor and through the absurd structures of a more or less collectivized society. And since the modern view of life and its materialism has taken away from the single individual any possibility of bestowing on his destiny a transfiguring element and seeing it in it a sign and symbol, contemporary slavery should therefore be reckoned as one of the gloomiest and most desperate kinds of all times. It is not a surprise that in the masses of modern slaves, the obscure forces of world subversion have found an easy, obtuse instrument to pursue their goals. World subversion. Interesting. While in the places where it has already triumphed, the vast Stalinist work camps testify to how the physical and moral subjection of man to the goals of collectivization and of the uprooting of every value of the personality is employed in a methodical and even satanic way. Oof.
Oof. I would actually say that applies more so to, you know, the West now in our decline and what it does, you know, Soviet Russia.
So just to, contextualize this, he wrote this in 1934.
Yeah.
I read most of the way through this thinking it was at least the late 50s that this was written.
But
no, I'm completely wrong. This was 30s.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So can you imagine, you know, what his take on things would be if he were alive today? You know,
I think he might be pretty... I think exto is the word.
I think there'd be slow claps all around. He'd be looking at shit like Amazon and just thinking, wow.
Yeah, you did it, guys. Well done, Reddit.
Yeah, well done. Slow claps. Slave
class. And it is. It's just the whole, it's the wagey cage thing. You know, we all have our own wagey cages. Some of them have and don't, you know, some are better than others. But at the end of the day, you are a slave, essentially. That's you have a mortgage, which literally on your entire life, you know, everything's shit.
Well, that is it. Even even if you were to find a role, find a job, and you were to work in it, and you were in the wage cage, all right. Like, I get how you could make the argument that maybe you're not a slave, but it's like, well, what about the fact that you're in debt for half your life for your mortgage? What about in order to get that office wage cage? Maybe you're not in that, but if you are. You racked up a however many dollar debt, $50,000, $60,000 is not uncommon.
Mm-hmm.
So you are just a slave in a different way, a slave by a different word. You're a worker, right? You're a slave to consumption as well. I mean, look at the products that are pushed. And so he diagnosed this in the 1930s, and it couldn't be more applicable today if we had tried to make it so.
Yeah, absolutely.
The Stalinists' experience pales into comparison to our own.
Well, the only thing now is the gulags are invisible, or they're often multi-storied.
Yeah, it's an unconscious gulag. And people don't, because you get access to all these knickknacks and bullshit that, you know, a lot of people can sort of trundle through life and not notice any of this.
Yeah, big time. Big time.
Speaking of this, the whole modern slavery angle, I think in this chapter on slavery actually goes into that being the fate of people that get conquered. The thing is, one of the hot takes I thought I'd save for part two of this, because it's probably going to be more relevant there.
Mm-hmm.
But there are parts where tradition hasn't quite died off yet, has it?
There no, are, definitely.
people that still have their spiritual rituals and that still do own slaves. If we talk about this modern sense.
Yeah. Well, it's not even necessarily about the slavery thing. I know for myself that, particularly after reading this, but even beforehand, there was definitely a part of me that thought, when you see those pictures of undiscovered Amazon tribes firing arrows at drones that are trying to take pictures of them, I'm thinking, fucking go tribesmen.
Now that,
because
wasn't quite where I was going with this.
No, I get you.
Sentinel Island, yeah, definitely pretty based. We haven't taken them yet.
They're
a spirit. But no, who I was thinking of, who you might call an aristocracy, who own slaves and have rituals, might be the sort you find in the Virgin Islands.
Yeah. Referring to a certain Levantine tribe?
I'm referring to a certain global Italian food distribution network.
The Russian mafia, I assume, right?
Yeah, so some elements of tradition never really left. I don't know what the metaphysical characteristics of it are. I'd hate to try and fathom those depths.
Yeah, that's perhaps a path for another time. The metaphysical aspect of that, because there is some very twisted, you know, paths we could go down.
I have no doubt. And yeah, I think that, you know, we'll climb through another couple of episodes before we jump into that one.
Yeah.
So it's, speaking of paths, hell of a segue, but the end of chapter 16, which is about the bipartition of the traditional spirit. So asceticism. So ascetics, holy people, other people, path of action. Evola draws a pretty, you know, bright line between them, but people can graduate from one to the other. So in closing this chapter, he says, after a brief mention of the meaning of contemplative asceticism, it is necessary to say something about the other path, namely the path of action. While in contemplative asceticism, we find a mostly inner process in which the theme of detachment and the direct orientation towards transcendence are predominant. In the second case, we have an imminent process aimed at awakening the deepest forces of the human being and at bringing them to the limit, thus causing a super life to spring from life itself in a context of absolute intensity. This is the heroic life according to the sacred meaning often displayed in the traditional Eastern and Western worlds. The nature of such a realization causes it to present simultaneously an outer and an inner, a visible and an invisible aspect. Conversely, pure contemplative asceticism may also lie entirely in a domain that is not connected to the external world by something tangible. He's sort of setting up this dichotomy of, it's not enough to think, you can also do.
Yep, absolutely. I think he's, once again, he's taking that kind of dualistic approach where he's opposing two different ideas there. I suppose he's kind of contrasting the idea of asceticism, the severe discipline. I suppose you'd include a certain stoicism in that idea.
Sort of mystics, stoicism, yeah.
Yeah, so the refrain from certain things, which is definitely a traditional idea, absolutely. Right? Because it's the, you're avoiding the material, you're avoiding consumption of the material, and there can only be one reason for that, and that is the pursuit of something heavenly or something above.
I mean, just to throw it to, you know, like DeMarc and Mick and the rest of us, what I took away from this a lot as well is that I just couldn't help but thinking of, you know, any number of conservative academics. They just seem to have been, you know, on the bench the whole game.
There's not you mean really like been Jordan much action. Penis and stuff.
Well, I think that we've seen more, I suppose, you know, I'll finish up the reading. So the end of the chapter, he says, in relation to the path of action, in the next two chapters, I'm going to discuss the doctrine of holy war and the role played by games in antiquity. I will further develop the topic of heroic action, given the interest it should evoke in Western man, who, by virtue of his own nature, is more inclined to act than to contemplate. So I'd kind of, I don't know, I'd push back on the Peterson thing, because he's sort of been touring the world a bit and getting up all the right noses and, you know, saved quite a few lives from what I understand. He's sort of been somebody who's been vocal and been out there. I suppose my venom would be more reserved for people who, you know, maybe publish the occasional quarterly article but aren't really seen in public that much. You know what I mean?
Is your take on this, though, that he's revering the man of action, or that he's kind of almost counter-signaling the man of action and I can't quite think of the word for it, but I'm going to use decrying the rejection of an ascetic value. What do you guys think of that?
I think he actually, like, because he's Western himself, he is saying he reckons Westerners favor more the warrior path. He does seem to like the warrior path a bit more. I think in the prologue it said he just reckons his warrior caste. So he does go on a bit more for that, but he didn't disrespect the ascetic monk type, like contemplative asceticism.
Yeah.
So no, he valued
it. Unfair to compare an ascetic monk to a neocon journo.
Fair cop.
That's a bit harsh on ascetic monks. There's nothing wrong with ascetic monks.
Could have just become an ascetic warrior, you know?
Hybrid. Well, that's if you're asking for my take, that's pretty much mine. I think that, yeah, in earlier chapters he made the case, he repeated Plato's argument that, you know, until kings are philosophers and philosophers are kings, we're up shit creek. I'm obviously paraphrasing.
That was a direct quote.
Yeah. Yeah. If only that you need both elements in tandem, and both are valuable, perhaps for different reasons, but, you know, should both be looked at as critical. And that sense of heroic action needs to be better, like, best informed by the other factors he's laid out.
It certainly doesn't seem to have an opposition to pairing what he makes out to be seemingly contradictory. I'm pretty sure he described himself as a Catholic pagan at one point in his life. So there is this thing where he does the bipolar thing, but then sometimes he'll pair these things that he makes out to be contradictory, which is unusual, but it does work at times when he does it.
Just going to say that if he was alive and on Twitter right now, he'd be one of those guys that has a different political ideology every week but is always just extreme in whatever it is.
Yeah. Quite possibly, yeah.
He'd be a groiper.
He'd definitely be a groiper, yeah.
So clearly, he clearly valued the warrior caste. Yeah, in the next chapter is the Greater and Lesser Holy War, chapter 17. Little pullout from that I got was, thus, according to the Nordic races, no sacrifice or cult was more cherished by the supreme god and thought to bear more supernatural fruits than the one celebrated by the hero who falls on the battlefield. From a declaration of war to its bloody conclusion, the religious element permeated the Germanic hosts and inspired the individual warrior as well. Moreover, in these traditions, we find the idea that by means of heroic death, the warrior shifted from the plane of the material earthly war to the plane of a struggle of a transcendent and universal character. Instead of advocating, therefore, the value, I suppose, in that, or pointing to the traditional appreciation of heroic action or battle.
Yeah. Well, if you are to take the traditional perspective, there's kind of no way that you can reject that, because your understanding is that you'll kind of inhabit this immortal setting, right? So Christians inhabit that they go to heaven, and this group here, the Germanic tribes, understood that they would go and dine in the halls at Valhalla, right? And I suppose that's, you can't reject that if you're to take a truly traditional perspective, right?
No, and to his credit, in a way, and obviously I'm looking at this from a contemporary perspective, he directly then, in this chapter as well, cites the mandates from the Quran to do the same thing. I'm sure we all know the passages by now. We spent enough time in the counter-jihad space.
Yeah.
And talks about, you know, sort of Hindu traditions as well. I pulled something from when he was referring to the Hindu traditions and their views on this. So he said that the teaching Krishna imparts to Arjuna concerns, first of all, the distinction between what is pure and undying and that which, as a human and naturalistic element, only appears to exist. the quote that I really got was, "The unreal never is, the real never is not. The truth indeed has been seen by those who can see the true, interwoven in his creation. The spirit is beyond destruction. No one can bring to an end the spirit which is everlasting. If any man thinks he slays, and if another thinks he is slain, neither knows the ways of truth. The eternal in man cannot kill. The eternal in man cannot die. He does not die when the body dies. These bodies have an end in their time, but he remains immeasurable, immortal. Therefore, great warrior, carry on thy fight." I mean, that, I don't know, that got me. I figured that, you know, there's so many common threads talking about this metaphysical dimension to combat or to war or to just life itself and an afterlife. And it's clear that Evola, you know, sought to cite quite a few of them and placed a fair bit of importance on it.
Yeah, he speaks very, well, I mean, he writes very powerfully, and he uses these kind of grand imagery when he goes into these kind of ideas and when he's talking about really ideological things. And it's almost just, I suppose it has a romanticism to it. It's not something you can really refute. It's just a grand idea, a philosophy of life and of death. But also something that's completely, as we discussed earlier, completely parallel to the way anyone today understands things. And, you know, I suppose that's why that kind of brings me back to the point where you can't really refute it. It's just a different philosophy. It's not incorrect or correct. It's, you know.
Well, for this chapter, he sets it out and he then goes on to contrast it really sharply in the conclusion. Did anybody else have some points on just those first couple of quotes?
I was going to say the last one is the sort of thing that I would say to myself to psych myself up for something, you know?
Yeah.
Reminds me a lot of the old samurai one about the victorious warrior being the one that fights like he's already dead.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's interesting to note that. And like you said, it's sort of definitely a romantic perspective, or it's one that, you know, it's above objective or material refutation. It's not something that's necessarily up for argument objectively. And like we said before, you know, that's not where Evola is playing. So the contrast that he offers is in closing this chapter, when he says that the great ideas of humanity, democracy, and the right of a people to self-determination have been mobilized. From an external point of view, not only is the idea of holy war considered outdated, but also the understanding of it that people of honor had developed. The heroic ideal has now been lowered to the figure of the policeman, because the new crusades have not been able to find a better flag to rally around than that of the struggle against the aggressor. From an inner point of view, behind all this rhetoric, what proved to be decisive was the brute, cynical will to power of obscure international capitalist and collectivist powers. At the same time, science has promoted an extreme mechanization and technologization of war, so much so that today war is not a matter of man against man, but of machines against man. Rational systems of mass extermination are being employed through indiscriminate air raids, atomic weapons, and chemical warfare that leave no hope and no way out. Such systems could once have only been devised to exterminate germs and insects. In contrast to medieval superstitions that refer to holy war, what our contemporaries consider sacred and worthy of the actual progress of civilization is the fact that millions of human beings, taken away en masse from their occupations and vocations, which are totally alien to the military vocation, and literally turned into what military jargon refers to as cannon fodder, will die in such events. I feel like that. I feel like that neatly described the world wars. The first one of which he would have seen, and the second one he would have also seen after he wrote this book.
Yeah, I think as well with...
Go on.
I think with this book as well, I think there was it kind of editions of it. So I think he did update it in the 50s as well. So there could be even, like, he might have even... I'm not sure if we've gone through the you know, the 34 edition or whatever. So I'm sure there is some things he might have added in upon reflection of World War II, on World War II.
Maybe, yeah. I didn't look into it.
Yeah. He did kind of have this this view of war as, once again, with the idea obviously of the immaterial and the immortal as like a kind of glorious thing rather than the way we see it today, which is sad or you know, brutal.
I think warfare prior to the First World War sort of had a great sense of honor, and you can kind of see after the First World War, people were becoming, I guess, less and less sort of open to the idea of dying for one's country up until today, you know, where it's literally we just go and fight another war for a certain country in some Middle Eastern backwater. I was going to go somewhere with this. Yeah, it's a massive mechanized slaughter. There is no honor in that. You know, we killed millions upon millions of men of fantastic quality.
Yeah, it's another tragedy. It's something that strikes me every time, you know, you get off the highways in any sort of regional part of Australia, there's a war memorial, and you just look at the names and think, that was, what was it? It's hard for that, you know.
Yeah, you look at the,
you can understand the heroic struggle.
You look at the names and then you look at what's happening around you, and you know, you kind of wonder if it was all worth it.
Yeah, if they had known that this was the result, did they go and die for it? You know, perhaps without this immortal, you know, this infinite end to it all, perhaps they don't. You know, operating in the material, it's very likely they don't go and die for it. So, so yeah.
If only they knew.
So he pushes on in chapter 18. He talks about games and victories. I suppose it's a natural extension from war. So interestingly, he talks about games and tradition as assuming the character of res divinae, so like divine rule. They've been replaced today by contemporary sports and by the plebeian infatuation with them. In the Hellenic tradition, the institution of the most important games bore a close relationship with the idea of the struggle of Olympian, heroic, and solar forces against natural and elemental forces. So that's how he sort of sets up the chapter and gets it going. Later on, he talks through that, you know, the fact remains that modern man needs these degraded and desecrated forms of action as if they were some kind of drug, and this is referring to modern games and sport. He needs them to elude the sense of his inner emptiness, to be aware of himself, and to find in exasperated sensations the surrogate for the true meaning of life. One of the characteristics of the Western Dark Age, Kali Yuga, is a sort of titanic restlessness that knows no limitations and that induces an existential fever and awakens new sources of elation and of stupefaction.
So just finding itself more distractions, essentially.
And in the context of, go on.
It's quite similar to the materialism and fall we were talking about in leadership as well. In that, back in the day, you had the Colosseum, which was, it was a spiritual event. It was actually relevant culturally and on a higher level. Whereas today you get North FC.
North, N-O-R-F, North. HMS North.
Yeah, he talks through this chapter. I encourage, if people out there don't read anything else, maybe just read, you know, chapters sort of 18 onwards, because this will sum it up pretty nicely, at least what's going to be more relevant to us going forward. Yeah, he talks about that. He talks about the metaphysical elements of the games, and in tradition they were tied to other struggles, or, you know, the legitimacy of rulers and that kind of thing, or they were champions of particular notions or figures, and now obviously being, I suppose, debased to what they are. But it's notable, though, you know, just, I guess, to throw this into it, that it does mobilize people.
Yep.
For better or worse. It's really interesting to note that
the better, same, or for worse, or for nothing. That's what I'd add on absolutely. To that, because it is all for naught, essentially.
Yeah, the whole thing starts again next year, right?
Yeah, exactly.
But it is, I suppose you would say, if nothing else, it's a sign of a desire to be, to kind of grasp that collectivism and to become the collective and be part of a collective effort. You know, even as a modern sports fan in the stands, you are, it is an action to, I suppose, in a way, to go and to support and to be part. It is a collective effort in a way.
Yeah, it's just what happens to man minus any abject spirituality. You know, if he's been deprived of spirituality, he just kind of finds these trivial things to
It's interesting.
Dump his time into.
Yeah, it's interesting you put that, because one of the criticisms, and it's what Evola finishes up the chapter with, is that metaphysical character of the individual. I don't know if he's quite on point with this, because I think a lot of people would argue that certain sports figures do have, you know, whatever it might be about them. But I'll just go through this reading and then we can maybe talk to it a bit, where he talks about the actual sort of divine or metaphysical characters of sports figures and figures in the game in tradition. And he said that these views were destined to be regarded as pure superstition wherever progress systematically deprived the human virtues of any possibility of establishing an objective contact with the superior order of things.
Mm-hmm.
Once man's strength was thought to be on the same level as that of animals, that is, as the faculty of mechanical action in a being who is not at all connected to what transcends him as an individual, the trial of strength obviously becomes meaningless, and the outcome of every competition becomes entirely contingent and lacking a potential in relation with an order of higher values. Once the ideas of truth, law, and justice were turned into abstractions or social conventions, once the sensation, thanks to which in Aryan India was possible to say the earth has truth as its foundation, was forgotten, once every perception of these values as objective and almost physical apparitions of the supernatural amid the network of contingencies was lost, then it's natural to wonder how truth, law, and justice could possibly influence the determination of the phenomena and facts that science, until recently, has decreed not to be susceptible to modification.
Yeah.
Very interesting take. Yeah. As they have all been so far.
Hmm.
Go on, you had something to say there, Timos?
No, it continues on to sort of bring it right up to the modern day, whereas nowadays decisions with regard to what is true or right, as well as matters of innocence and guilt, are left to the clamour of pettifoggers. I had to look that up. the laborious promulgation of legal documents, the lengthy paragraphs of laws that are equal for everybody and made omnipotent by the secularized states, exactly, and the plebeian masses who rule themselves without kings and self-appointed rulers. Conversely, the proud self-assurance with which the traditional man reacted valiantly and super-individually against the unrighteous, armed with faith and the sword, and the spiritual impassibility that placed him into an a priori absolute relation to a supernatural power, not the subject to the power of the elements, sensations, and natural laws. All these things have come to be considered mere superstitions.
Christ.
It's interesting to see him, because he obviously talks about hierarchy, which we think of being kind of a pyramid-shaped idea, and he talks about things being oriented upwards as well. And here he talks about, in the secular society, people under I haven't quite remembered the term, but a hyper-individualist is the word I'm going to go with.
Yeah, super individual. Yeah,
in their super individualism, they are still ruled over just without any divine authority. It's simply artificially constructed authority. I think that's an interesting idea, is that he's contrasting a divine hierarchy with a natural hierarchy.
Mm.
Yeah, something interesting to note about his philosophy.
Yeah.
It's also interesting just how he wound up in this situation that we're in now, considering this bloke almost wrote this 100 years ago.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Perturbs me.
It's very interesting that this work in itself, and also obviously the ideas that sprung out of it, have lasted the test of time. and proved to be, yeah, pretty close to a prediction. Next chapter is a bit of a doozy. So it's called Space, Time, the Earth. Do you have any takes on this, Demok, or have you got any notes for it?
On Space, Time, and Earth?
Mm.
What I do find interesting here was that when it gets to the space part of it, some places being more important than others or being more spiritually potent.
Mm.
That was an interesting take there.
Yeah, I pulled that out as well. Talking about the fact that, you know, traditional men didn't need to think about an experience of a place. It wasn't a sort of, you know, process of going out and sitting in the woods and just meditating about it until something popped into his mind. He had an experience of it that was, you know, it was very real. It wasn't a product of his physical senses. It would be similar to what we might experience, you know, if we were those kind of people under the influence of drugs or something like that. You know, it was that palpable for people in tradition, their relationship with nature and with particular places. What he calls in the text, noumena. So this is a special powers, yeah.
Absolutely. It is an interesting chapter. What I kind of drew out of it as being quite interesting is I think he describes a kind of non-linear time for the men of tradition. I think it's we these days, and I could be extrapolating this into a modern sense that perhaps is not what he meant.
Mm.
But you look at a society today where we're time-based, we're meeting deadlines, we're having to respond to emails, phone calls, messages in a timely manner. In the past, I suppose, in a traditional society in which you had your role or your position in a caste in a society, the application of linear time is not necessarily so important anymore. You're simply fulfilling your role. And the only time that I suppose matters is the time when you sleep, the time when you eat, and the time when you fulfill your role.
The time you eat chicken tendies as well. Mm. Warrior aesthetic neat.
Time to drop through the Wendy's drive-through.
Time for a Macca's run.
Yeah. But I found that to be an interesting point that he made. And I'm not sure how accurate it is about time being non-linear for the ancient man, but it was an interesting kind of thought process, I thought.
Yeah, there was one more quality apart from sort of the metaphysical experience or the kind of really palpable experience of different places and non-linear time. He also talks about the relationship between man and land. So I'm going to do the same thing that I did with the previous chapter. So there's a little quote from the middle, and then I'll jump to the conclusion where he sort of references it. In the middle, he said, from a traditional point of view, between man and his land, between blood and soil, there existed an intimate relationship of a living and psychic character. Since a given area had a psychic individuality in addition to its geographic individuality, those who were born in it were bound to be deeply affected by it. So I think that there he's obviously sort of talking to the tie that people felt to the place that they were born. The fact that it wasn't the same kind of relationship that we'd appreciate now. In framing how land's seen now, he says, the land, which may also belong to a merchant, the owners of the capitalist bourgeois age may be regarded as the modern equivalent of an ancient merchant caste, or to a serf, our modern worker, is a desecrated land, in conformity with the interests typical of the two inferior castes, which have succeeded in taking the land away from the ancient type of feudal lords. The land is only valued from an economic point of view, and it is exploited as much as possible with machines and other modern technical devices. That being the case, it is natural to encounter other typical traits of a degeneration, such as the property increasingly shifts from the individual to the collectivity. Parallel with the collapse of the aristocratic title to the lands and the economy having become the main factor, what emerges first is nationalism, which is followed by socialism, and finally by Marxist communism. In other words, there is a return to the rule of the collective over the individual that reaffirms the collectivist and promiscuous concept of property, typical of inferior races, as an overcoming of private property, and as nationalization, socialization, and proletarization of goods and of lands.
That's interesting.
It is an interesting take, isn't it? He seems to take an individualist perspective here. He seems to...
Yeah, well, that's what I was thinking too. He's kind of turned on a dime, hasn't he?
Yeah.
Mm.
Well, he does do this... Sorry, go on, Democ.
He does turn around a bit, or at least from our perspective, appears to be all over the place on individualism and collectivism. But when he brings up the terms as such, I'd imagine he's working on a slightly different definition than what we'd immediately think. He always says he's an individualist or goes for individual interests.
Well, he did say earlier that every man has their place in society. And
he'd be considering it from that perspective. So land ownership would be an individual issue for the landed gentry.
Mm.
And in the case of lower castes or casteless people, that would be out of place for them.
Well, yeah, that's a point that he makes earlier in that chapter, is that, you know, traditionally those lands would have been the sole domain of a particular aristocrat or ruler that had, you know, divine rights and qualities that he's outlined before. And the people that worked that land had a close relationship to it. And there was an order to that. And that was the collective as it stood. I think that he's contrasting that with collectives as their modern, you know, as they exist in modernity. So as he points out, the sort of socialist and Marxist collectives, you know, that would seek to turn it over potentially to that sort of mechanized, or at least now, as we absolutely see mechanized agriculture just on a scale that defies belief.
Yeah.
And
I think as well, perhaps in his diagnosis of collectivism as an issue here is you see kind of throughout the book, he has a lot of kind of, I'm not going to say, I am going to say actually disdain. I think it's a stronger word than I mean, but I'm going to use the word disdain for kind of these, the proletariat class or the lower class. He has a very aristocratic sense of things.
He's got a disdain for plebs.
He's got a disdain for
plebs. Yeah, absolutely.
He calls them disdain for plebs.
Extreme disdain for plebs. Well, he calls them plebs throughout the entire book. Well, he calls them plebeians, I suppose. But I think perhaps in this sense, he might be referring even to things like workers' unions and things like that. As a kind of, from an aristocratic perspective, that would be a kind of abomination.
Collective.
Yeah, an abominable collective. So.
So the next chapter is man and woman. So I've got, and this is probably more highlighted than text for me at this point, because this was a massive one considered in contrast with what we see around us now. Did anyone else get anything from reading it?
Yeah, e-girls will cry if they see a word in this chapter.
Yeah, e-girls BTFO'd big time.
Yeah.
Belle Delphine just had like a shiver down her spine at the mention of Julius Evola's last chapter.
Yeah.
Just women in general dabbed on left and right.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's. I think it's not so much that, because it's not necessarily what I took away. What I took away was that both women and men dabbed on by modernity pretty harsh.
Okay, yeah. Modern
women. And as a consequence, women continue to dab on men who are worthy only of being dabbed on. That should be the show title.
Dab against the modern world.
Yeah.
Oh, I think that's it.
That's not bad. Backpedal a little just to say modern women.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's funny you should say that. It segues into one quote that I thought I'd pull out. He says, due to such a misunderstanding, and this is a women imitating a male personality so that women's claims conceal a fundamental lack of trust in herself as well as her inability to be and to function as a real woman and not as a man. Spicy takes. Due to such a misunderstanding, the modern woman has considered her traditional role to be demeaning and has taken offense at being treated only as a woman. This was the beginning of a wrong vocation. Because of this, she wanted to take her revenge, reclaim her dignity, prove her true value, and compete with men in a man's world. But the man she set out to defeat is not at all a real man, only the puppet of a standardized, rationalized society that no longer knows anything that is truly differentiated and qualitative. In such a civilization, there obviously cannot be any room for legitimate privileges, and thus women who are unable and unwilling to recognize their natural traditional vocation and to defend it, even on the lowest possible plane, since no woman who is sexually fulfilled ever feels there's a need to imitate and to envy man, very, very spicy take, could easily demonstrate that they too virtually possess the same faculties and talents, both material and intellectual, that are found in the other sex, and that, generally speaking, are required and cherished in a society of the modern type. Man, for his part, has irresponsibly let this happen, and has even helped and pushed women into the streets, offices, schools, and factories, into all the polluted crossroads of modern culture and society. Thus, the last leveling push has been imparted.
It's a good take.
It's probably an extremely spicy take, I have to say. Mm. Very delicious.
Straight up and clear.
Yeah.
If I was to come up with something like that, it would probably take me 2 years to write that down. But
it's, yeah,
it's phenomenal.
I think it's not a take that's uncommon amongst our circles. So like this, of all the things he says, I know there is some that would even be counter-signaled by our guys. This is not one. This seems like one that would be logical to us. But then the funny thing is, I think this really is reminiscent of his Doctrine of the Caste chapter as well. It's the you're born into your role kind of idea. But funnily enough, I think that that Doctrine of the Caste is something that would be harder to come to terms with for people, even in our movement, definitely most people in the modern world. But this chapter seems pretty normal.
The way that he describes a lot of the things that we've foisted women onto, though, you kind of, it sounds like he has disdain for them, and He's essentially putting them on a pedestal, I guess, to sort of say that you've got a biological role that is, I guess, higher up than what any of this bullshit is. And you should.
Yeah, I think that's actually further evidenced by something he puts forward in the conclusion. I mean, the only thing, like you were saying, Bronce, that I might struggle with in that reading was that, and it was in brackets, I suppose. And I think it's fair to say that Evola spent a fair bit of time around the woman question and talking about sex and the rest of it. I haven't read his books on it and that kind of stuff, so I can't talk to it too much. But the thing that I would have struggled with was, even on the lowest possible plane, since no woman who is sexually fulfilled ever feels a need to imitate and to envy man. I don't know. I don't know enough. I don't know about the fulfillment, but I think in context it makes sense, because he's talking about the kind of man that doesn't exist anymore and those sort of relationships. In the conclusion of the chapter, he says, the same holds true for the results of the Western emancipation of women, which is on its way to infecting the rest of the world faster than a plague. It didn't quite pan out. Traditional woman, or the absolute woman, in giving herself, in her living for another, in wanting to be only for another being with simplicity and purity, fulfilled herself, belonged to herself, displayed her own heroism, and even became superior to ordinary men. Modern woman, in wanting to be for herself, has destroyed herself. The personality she so much yearned for is killing all semblance of female personality in her.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, I see where you're coming from there with the that you don't quite agree, or you're iffy with that take in the brackets. Would you mind reading that bit in the brackets again for me?
So he says, even on the lowest possible plane, since no woman who is sexually fulfilled ever feels the need to imitate and to envy man.
Yeah, I would not necessarily disagree with that, but I'd slightly disagree with the wording, and I'd say the idea that a woman who is not sexually fulfilled is going to try to imitate a man, I would say a woman who is not actually fulfilled is going to try to imitate a man. And I think actual fulfillment is going to come from, funnily enough, a lot of the things that Evola discusses, which is a spiritual perspective, a focus on a higher goal, and I think also traditional values such as a family and children and things of that nature.
Well, the thing that he says about that is
Richard Spencer, sorry, telos is the higher goal. That's a good way of describing it.
Ends of things,
As for that part about sexually unsatisfied women behaving like men, I have a really strong feeling he might have like originally been going with generally fulfilled, but there was one guy he knew that was just a massive simp whose wife was, you know, going full
a butch lesbian.
Yeah, his wife was just turning into a butch lesbian, and he was just like, yeah, you know what? I'm making it sexual just because fuck that guy.
Yeah, I'm putting a bracket in there for you, mate.
Dropping it next
guy. I hope he reads my book.
Yeah, but he does, from what we've just said, he does say that in the end she'll incur forms of corruption that usually accompany superficiality, namely a practical and superficial lifestyle of a masculine type that has perverted her nature and thrown her into the same male pit of work, profits, frantic activity and politics.
Yeah, well, that's where we are today.
We have unsatisfied women leading countries into the ground, a la Angela Merkel.
Well, there's evidence that they're unsatisfied. I mean, as I brought up earlier, there's studies that shows declining happiness, declining, you know, general satisfaction since it was being recorded. So that is a phenomena that we're seeing. And what are we also seeing more of is women in the workplace, women trying to run countries and things like that, you know.
Well, also, you know, not to get into too much of the sort of the crimes of modernity, you know, citing all the science and rationalism around it. But if you look into something called the Nordic paradox, it's very, very interesting. But put simply, it's that, you know, when rates of gender equality in terms of access to the workplace and other positions increases, women's participation doesn't rise at the same rate or nowhere near the same rate that they would have expected. And by they, you can read into that whatever you like.
Yeah. Of course. Women secretly more trad than we generally give them credit for.
Yeah, that's pretty much the sort of, you know, subtitle for the Nordic paradox.
I think there is like an innate biologically like ingrained quality to them that sort of says, okay, I've got a set amount of years in which I kind of be my most fertile and I have to, you know, get something within that window. And you sort of see this with people with baby envy is what I like to say. You know, if their friends have got children, you know, they get very...
it gets manic.
Motherly. Yeah, it does.
As somebody of a particular age, you start to sort of see the game of reproductive musical chairs kick off and people start seeing, you know, oh, they're having a kid and then they've got one and they've got, oh, shit. And I haven't found a chair. And the music's going to stop any minute.
Is running out. Yep. In the physical sense, it's like that's your entire purpose on this planet, really, is to go forth and reproduce, isn't it?
Well, and this is one of the things that we were talking about when we were talking about traditionalism and modernity and belief systems that are aligned with nature and belief systems that are not. And one of the things that's very clearly aligned with nature is understanding not only, you know, the capacity to, but also your potential desire or will to reproduce, and that that's a perfectly natural and that's a fine thing. And look into the media anywhere you may care to, and I challenge you to find something that advocates for it.
Yeah,
it's definitely. It's become a pretty hostile climate for it, and yet completely in line with nature.
Yeah, and funnily enough, it's complemented by consumption and materialism. I see. We see the stagnation of the price of, you know, things that you might need to buy if you have a child, things like toys or cribs or things like that. Those, the prices of those things haven't changed. But what has changed is the price of things like going on a holiday or buying a handbag. And it's like, well, like what's the message here? What's the subtle message? It's like, well, don't have the child. You don't need that. And plus it's more expensive. Go on a holiday instead, or get yourself those shoes or something like that. So.
The price of melamine-free baby powder has changed.
Yeah. Oh, don't. That, yeah, that rattled. I remember when that first started happening, I was living in a state that might have been called ground zero for the baby formula catastrophe. And, every single time that I'd subject myself to a supermarket, I'd come out pretty rattled by it. So Evelyn doesn't just go through the sort of woman question, as some of our guys might term it. He also kicks the ball onto men. So the Chapter 21, the final chapter for part one, is titled The Decline of Superior Races. So we might spend a fair bit of time on this.
How much time have we got?
I got a bit. Clock? We're good.
I'm happy. I've had like so much coffee this evening. Keep going.
So in The Decline of Superior Races, he says, today, all this should frame this. So in the woman, abyssal powers of passion and light, of danger and disintegration were evoked. The chthonic power, namely the earth, lived in her while heaven lived in man. Everything that's experienced by ordinary men in the form of peripheral sensations and passional and corporeal impulses was assumed in an organic and conscious way. Generation was decreed, and the being who was generated was willed as the child of duty, namely as one who must undertake and nourish the supernatural element of his stock and the liberation of the ancestor, and who must receive and pass on to future generations strength, life, and stability. Today, all this has become an inane fancy. Men, instead of being in control of sex, are controlled by it and wander about like drunkards without having the least clue as to what takes place in the course of their embraces and without seeing the guiding principle acting behind their quest for pleasure or behind their own passions. Without people being aware of any of this, beyond and often against their own will, what comes into existence as a result of their intercourse is a new being who will have no spiritual continuity and, as in the case of the most recent generations, even without the pale residue constituted by bourgeois affective bonds.
If only he knew the advent of the contraceptive pill. Again, he would be exposing again, I think.
Yeah. I hadn't thought of that.
He knew the advent of Twitch donations.
Gamer girl bathwater.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Although the good news is, if we could somehow get the message through some occult channel to Evola about Twitch donations, we would solve the energy crisis because you could just rig a turbine up to him spinning in his grave.
Very, very good take. Very renewable energy, very eco-friendly.
I don't know, how would he describe
Evola rage now
that we have, consequence-free intercourse, essentially, where you don't actually have to create a soulless, spiritualist being out of your, actions. I wonder how he would describe what we have now, other than the way that I can describe it, which is with one word, like gay play.
Yeah, well, I don't think he'd be surprised. I think this is kind of the natural evolution of what he...
It's the Evola evolution.
The Evola evolution, that's right. But it is the natural Evola evolution of what he was kind of perceiving as he wrote this, I think.
Well, he calls men to account. I suppose that's all of us too. He says... Thus, the best and most authentic reaction against feminism and against every other female aberration should not be aimed at women as such, but at men instead. So he's the first on the Me Too train. It should not be expected of women that they return to what they really are and thus re-establish the necessary inner and outer conditions for a reintegration of a superior race, when men themselves retain only the semblance of true virility. Oof. If all efforts to reawaken the spiritual dimension of sexuality fail, and if the form of virility is not separated from what has become an amorphous and promiscuous spiritual substance, then everything is in vain. The virility that is physical, phallic, muscular, and animal is lifeless and does not contain any creative germ in the superior sense. Phallic man, I think by that he means, deceives himself by thinking that he dominates. The truth is that he is passive and is always susceptible to the subtler powers of women and the feminine principle. The differentiation of the sexes is authentic and absolute only in the spirit. An interesting take there.
That is a pretty interesting take.
Very interesting. He does kind of indicate the weakness of the physical man. I think that kind of gets it. Well, one thing we've seen that disappearing in is the kind of, we don't no longer have this construct of like no sex before marriage. That's now been completely rejected. First thing that came to my mind there.
Right. Yeah, when I read that section the first time, it sort of highlighted the whole thing. I couldn't help but think of The Bachelorette and just thinking, I've never seen more of a rogue's gallery of physical, phallic, muscular, animal men that don't have any super individual qualities really at all.
Yeah.
They're all just carbon copies of one another, aren't they?
Mm. And just this sort of animal, yeah, relation. There's nothing necessarily above and beyond that. I mean, I know that what I'm talking about is just pablum. It's just garbage.
But it is kind of the ultimate representation of modernity. It's like a very vapid and materialistic and physical view of this thing. And it is all about the physical. You look at the even when they're discussing each other or when they're talking to each other, there's nothing of substance there at all. There's simply
it's just an exchange of words.
Or fluid.
Yeah. When it gets to that point, definitely. But it's the 80-20 rule on TV, essentially. That's all I think it is.
So Evola goes on to say, if the expired civilization is propped up so as to make it look alive, and if men are treated like rabbits or stallions, their unions being carefully and rationally planned, let no one be fooled. What they will generate will either be a civilization of very beautiful animals destined to work, or, if the individualistic and utilitarian element predominates, a stronger law will lead the races toward a path of regression or extinction, according to the same inexorability of the law of entropy and the degradation of energy. What will then be registered by future historians is only one of the several aspects of the decline of the West that are today very much in evidence.
I think we know which way we're headed. I think we're headed towards the regression and extinction. Certainly of the races of humans, because we're being directed into, you know, the role of a consumer worker.
Yep.
And I think that's evidenced through advertising and which I would call all of the things I'm about to mention just propaganda, but like advertising, media, entertainment is all advocating for things that regress us as groups that are special.
Things that destroy us.
Things that destroy us, certainly. And turns you into a group of identical people with no distinguishing factors, no distinguishing cultures around the world, but with one trait, and that is the ability to, you know, work and consume.
So. Get in the cage, get in the wagey cage, consume the product, and then get excited for the next product.
That's it. Yeah.
The other option probably looked a lot more possible in the 1930s.
I think it was a certain European country, I think.
Yeah, I think they were interested in that, creating a beautiful race, weren't they?
Yeah, and the 1,000-year something, I can't remember.
I forgot the term.
So
there's a particular term that you used, Timos, to describe something that sort of reminded me of an experiment that was done with mice called the Beautiful Ones. And it was, they gave all these mice just everything their wanton needs could ever desire. And what ended up happening was what you kind of see now with the tail end of the Occident and our civilizational collapse, is that you end up with a race of beautiful ones, essentially beautiful people, beautiful mice in this case, but they didn't reproduce. They would fight each other, and the females would just kill themselves or exhibit habits that, you know, you wouldn't see in nature, I guess.
So Evola closes out the first part of the book, and I suppose the meat of the podcast, with this. The object of the considerations I will articulate in the second part of my work is to analyze this process of decadence, together with all those processes that have led to the collapse of primordial humanity. Through these, the genesis and face of the modern world will become manifest. Yeah. So that's what we're leading to next episode. So I feel we covered...
Wunderbar.
Yeah, we covered a bit of a smorgasbord, little sort of pick and choose of part one. Again, you know, I really enjoyed it. I really got a lot out of it. I hope that other people got something out of it and hopefully go and read the book for themselves. It's not a short read, but it's worthwhile.
Yeah. And it's a heavy read as well. I mean, the language and the topics are, sometimes you got to give it a second, you know, peruse to understand it. Well, at least I did. I'm a grub brain, but.
You should sit down and devote 100% of your attention to. It's not an easy read. It's not a light read. It really does, you know, get those cogs up in your noggin a jogging.
Make you think.
It does, yeah. precisely.
Yeah. So on that note, with the podcast, so with Route to the Right, we're going to try and finish, well, we are going to finish every episode with some sort of recommendation of something you can do. So some practical advice to go away and do something in the intervening time, or just to try something in your own life to get a bit more of a foundation underneath you. So for this one, I had written down something that I've tried recently and I noticed it's made a massive difference in my life, which is for an hour after you get up, don't touch or look at a screen. Don't pick up your phone. Don't look at the TV. Don't go to your computer. Just avoid it. Spend the time reading or, you know, exercising or whatever you do. Maybe it's a good time to start reading Revolt, but don't go straight for the news cycle or straight for, you know, apps or whatever. Yeah. Do you guys think...
Just unplug.
Yeah, just unplug. At least for the first hour of your day, right?
Yeah, I like that recommendation. I really do. I've got to say, I'm one of the people who falls into the trap of looking at screens. And I'll look at a screen, you know, all day while I'm doing whatever, while I'm walking out to my car, I'll be watching my phone or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
The closest I get to really getting away from it is every now and again, I'll take a period of time, maybe a week, and I'll just I'll avoid political issues. I'll avoid the news cycle. And that does enough to reset my brain. And really, it doesn't affect how up-to-date you are with things, because the news cycle these days moves so quickly that you know, everyone's forgotten about last week's news anyway. So
precisely.
Yeah. Mm.
Down the memory hole, as it were. That's yeah, look, it. I mean, it was less than 10 years ago that you could go an entire week without looking at your phone. So it's good to sort of unplug from these things from time to time. Just sort of go outside, you know, smell the flowers.
Mm.
Get stung by the insects, whatever.
100%, yeah. Mm. Your bee by your beehive.
Yeah,
Are we each making a different recommendation, or?
Yeah, if you've got something, chuck it in. Definitely.
I do have an idea. It's especially applicable to the people who I think will be finding our podcast not by accident. But I think in the essence of revolting against the modern world, I think direct your perspective inwards and go and find out about your family and your family's history and the culture of your people for those of you who are here for, you know, that reason. Understand your family and your family's history. And I think
don't do a DNA test like a 23andMe, because God, yeah, there's a certain people in charge of that sort of thing.
Yeah, don't send your data off to your big I won't say the word big whatever.
Corporation.
But yeah, understand your background, and you don't need to go and do a DNA test to understand it. We're not purity spiralists here, but go to, you know, if your grandparents are available, or go and even just you can do the ancestry tests and stuff like that and they can follow your family line back and go back a few generations and understand the roles they played, and it will be interesting, and you will gain an appreciation for what was pre-modern as far as the periodic era.
Yeah, that's great advice. I'm going to do that. For me, it'll be a bit of work, but I'll give it a crack.
Yeah, it'll be interesting. You'll enjoy it. It might take a bit of time out of your day, but...
Yeah.
I think, isn't it historically speaking, that people's preordained roles in society also determine what last name they had? So if you, for example, you know, we were a Fletcher in your heydays, you know, you made arrows, then your last name today would probably be Fletcher or something like that too.
Yeah, true.
Other than just an interesting aside.
I think some names as well come from like places where you live though, like next to a river by
what Scottish clan you belong to, etc.
By the big rock or something like that, you know.
Let's sort of find out. Did you have anything to mark?
Pings through the roof.
Yeah, I've got a just got a shout out Lunka Blunka.
Oh yeah, we gotta do that.
We got her.
Got her in. Oh good. And Mick, did you have any calls to action for our valued listeners?
Yeah, look, there's probably a few things that I could list, but just off the top of my head, I would say it doesn't really hurt to get into gardening.
Yeah.
Seriously.
I back that.
you gain a fantastic sense of self-satisfaction just by growing your own food. I can attest to this over the past few years, and it tastes better than pretty much anything you get off the shelf at a grocery store.
Excellent.
And it's not difficult. A lot of, you know, your day-to-day salad requirements can be met just with a Bunnings tote filled with water, a little hydroponic setup. Just stick it outside in the sun and make sure the algae doesn't eat it. And happy days.
So if you want to hit us up for gardening tips, more life advice, or reading recommendations, we've got an email address. So it's rootsoftheright@protonmail.com. So send us feedback, suggestions, and obviously we can send you back some gardening fact sheets. And if you want to get added to our Telegram group, or soon to be created, then we'll put you through a process of extreme vetting, as is tradition, and we'll see what we can do. But so in conclusion, read Eveler, don't touch your phone, do some gardening, find out who your family were. And thanks very much to everyone for listening. Those are my closing notes. Anyone else have anything?
Yeah, just also send us your credit card number.
And the expiry date and the three numbers on the back. Take that advice on board. Have a read. Hope you enjoyed the chat. And all right. Enjoy. Nice. Let's wrap it up.